Well, I'm very grateful to be here. A little timorous, I must say. Daniel amongst the lions, although you look very postprandially lions, I have to say. I don't think you could damage anybody even if you growled. But to have a go at this title that I've been given, Mission or Mystery? Well, there are some mysteries included in the pack that we've all been given. For example, it states that there are two Philip Chesters. Well, since there's more than enough of the one I know, I can't really think that there can be another. And I took great delight in seeing that Bishop John is down and his diocese is declared as null. And deanery the same. Whereas I, as a mere Methodist minister, have a diocese, a deanery, and a role. But then many bishops, of course, have forgotten that once upon a time they had all of those things. It's lovely to be here, and I hope just to share a few thoughts. Philip has welcomed the thought that I might say one or two challenging things. I was a month ago in Washington, D.C. I was preaching the two sermons to inaugurate a year of bicentennial celebrations for the Foundry United Methodist Church, which stands by the White House, where indeed Abraham Lincoln and Franklin Roosevelt, and more recently the whole Clinton family, have worshipped. And it was the bicentennial. And the Americans, with no sense of irony at all, I think, invited me to preach my sermons on the very day, the 200th anniversary of the day that the British Army came into Washington and burned it down. And irony is what I wonder about when I have been asked to preach or to speak about has the steam gone out of Christianity? Because, of course, in the early days of Methodism, the Church of England tried its hardest to knock the steam out of us. They called our steam enthusiasm. And enthusiasm was considered almost to be the sin against the Holy Spirit. And the Bishop of Exeter at that time, George Lavington, really did show such extraordinary enthusiasm in condemning enthusiasm that he can't have had much of a sense of irony either. So I'm going to try and put the steam back in, if it's at all possible. I know that all the indicators suggest that the steam has gone out of the Christian cause. The numbers are down. Us Methodists are in a very bad way. Our statistical returns recently showed that yet another huge decline across the board in all kinds of ways. Very sad indeed. When I came in to the Methodist ministry some 40 years ago, there were 675,000 Methodist members. There are now just over 200,000. That's pretty savage. I was reading in the Church Times, I've got to get in references like this to prove that I have some validity in your eyes. I was reading the Church Times and the report of the recent meetings of the Church in Wales, in Lampeter, where once upon a time I used to teach. And there, it seems even worse. 50,000 Easter communicants, for example, is all they could manage last year in Wales. And again, across all the sectors, the indicators are very bad indeed. Although it did say in the Church Times that there were rumors of life. And so I looked very eagerly for proof to substantiate that rather bold claim. Rumors of life. They amounted to, well, it was 12,000 people, it seems, who had been involved in duck pond services, in barn nativities, and in teddy bear services. So there's definitely hope for the church in Wales. Well, we must put behind us the thoughts of just going on with this excoriating exercise of identifying what's negative. We must just take for granted that this is a very challenging time indeed for the church. So what can we do about it? Is there anything we can do about it? Is there anything you at the deanery level should do about it? I always think that your deaneries are our circuits. I always think that this is the very body that I should be speaking to in order to build a grassroots intention, a grassroots movement to achieve that unity that has eluded us thus far. Bishops and people from the top have tried and failed. Perhaps it does have to be a grassroots movement building up from below. And if that's so, then the deanery and the circuit, why, they have so much in common. Groups of churches covering a defined area, pooling expertise, not having to duplicate effort, being more efficient, but also releasing energy for mission. Now, wouldn't that be a great way of looking at the deanery? I must say that I did look in that report that was just shared with us, and I found this extraordinary thing about lay chairs, feeling that their enthusiasm was sometimes being frustrated. That's what it says. That word enthusiasm again. So lay chairs, Methodists have known about enthusiasm frustrated for a very long time. And if your clergy are giving you trouble, count on the Methodists to support you, and we'll back you all the way. And just get them out of the way if that's the way they are. I mean, they take themselves, we take ourselves far too importantly sometimes. So, as I say, the tempting thing is to spend time just analyzing the decline, trying to understand it. I think we ought to set the decline in the church against a broader picture where there's decline all over the shop. But we ought also, because, I mean, the other cause that I'm caught up in is the Labour Party, which is in exactly the same state of lassitude as the churches are so often. Lost their way, lost their enthusiasm, lost their energy, dragged down in one way or another into this, that, and the other. So how do we pull ourselves up? Well, I think Scotland, which was mentioned earlier, is a starting point. Just look at the energy that was there for politics. Mind, we can't do all our public life at the level of single question referendums, yes or no. It would be lovely if we could. Can't. But there was a cause that the Scottish people as a whole felt they needed to inject energy into. Now, what are the causes that would get us excited in that way, that would bring back some of the energy, some of the enthusiasm, some of the passion that perhaps once upon a time existed? We're tired. We're tired. I went to Haiti in 1970. I went from Cambridge. I had just taken the Tripos, theological Tripos there, and I had done New Testament Greek, ethics, the Old Testament, patristic theology, the Reformation, the 19th century, a bit of philosophy of religion and so on, all the usual stuff. Went to Haiti because I spoke French. When I got there, I found I was given 48 churches to look after, a bishop before I was ordained, 48 churches where nobody spoke French. And one of the most liberating things that has ever happened to me was finding myself in a non-theological environment, because nobody could think theologically either, and where I could not communicate. Sometimes we do need to have ourselves stripped of all the layers of stuff that we have that have accreted onto us. We need to be disempowered. We need to be stripped back. It's like pruning the old rose tree, or getting all the old paint before you put the new paint on the wall, or whatever it is. And I have never been so liberated. It was, I keep on telling people, that the peasant people of Haiti did for me a mission job, which all the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't and didn't do for Humpty Dumpty. They put me back together again. Why? Because they taught me their language. They were patient with me and laughed at me when we made mistakes. They were generous to a fault, giving me their hospitality. They taught me their culture, their survival skills, their wisdom. These illiterate people, called by the anthropologist Frantz Fanon, les miséreux de la terre, the wretched of the earth. They put me back together again because I had been a very poor boy. I was brought up on benefits. It's two children raised by a single mother in a brickyard, one room. And Education had been my gateway to greater opportunities, but also my drawback, because education also makes you a little bit cocky, arrogant, believing in the gifts that you've got rather than the self that you are. And I went out full of cocksureness that I was going to bring to Haiti what nobody else ever had brought to Haiti, only to be cut right down to size. And it was the peasant people of Haiti who reunited out of their poverty me with my poverty and made me once again the whole person that I certainly wasn't prior to that. And sometimes I think that we have evolved ways of doing things. We've developed methods and models, and they just need to be smashed to pieces, got out the way. A fresh piece of paper, and here are the tasks that need doing. How are we going to organize ourselves to do them? Start with the work rather than the survival of the institution. The institution, I mean, we did hear earlier talk about the fact that too much time and energy is spent in maintaining buildings. Well, sometimes if you've got buildings, you've got to maintain them. There's no way out of it. But it's not for me the buildings that I worry about. It's the institutions I worry about. It's the fact that we have layer upon layer upon layer, subclause after subclause after subclause. I mean, I have survived as a Methodist minister for 40-something years, and every year I get a copy of the Constitutional Practice and Discipline of the Methodist Church. Every year I replace the old one with a new one because it's exactly the right size to prop up the fourth leg of the bed that I sleep on and stop it from tilting over. Of course, I have a healthy respect for authority and a healthy respect for proper ways of doing things, but I also have a fear of being so dominated by the letter of the law rather than the spirit of it, by having to conform. Being a nonconformist, let me tell you, is a very comfortable place to be. I'm a bit of a rebel. I think the institutionalization of the way we work, the way we are, is a very dangerous thing. For us all. And sometimes, when we used as Methodists to go to local preachers' meetings, we would have 2 hours of a meeting, of which an hour and a half was simply fulfilling and ticking off the agenda items as laid out in that wretched book, before we could talk about what are we communicating, to whom, what opportunities are there to spread this gospel message of ours abroad. Where can we take it? Who will hear? How do we develop the right language and discourse to be able to communicate in this context or that context? Where are the skills? Who has the experience? These are the questions I'm interested in working with. These are the questions that generate energy. Of course, to say these things in the presence of rural deans and a bishop, I better not look in his direction, is simply to seem to be a destructive, anti-constitutional, revolutionary. Yes, I'm all of those things. I've, at this stage in my ministry, I've had enough of being dominated by that stuff. There's simply too much work to do and too little time to do it in. And so I just feel I want to be led a little bit more by the Spirit rather than by the book. Now, Philip has mentioned Methodist Anglican cooperation. Well, I'm afraid you can't invite me to an Anglican meeting without me getting rather a lot of stuff off my chest. Because you really and truly have been dreadful. I mean, you as a church. I was a student at Cambridge in 1969. I went to my first Methodist conference that year. I went as a doorkeeper, a steward, because I wanted to hear the great debate, which, if the issue had worked out properly, would have brought our churches together. There had been 20-something years of discussions since Archbishop Geoffrey Fisher issued his great challenge to us in 1948. Here we were 20 years later on the point of voting. We required 75% majority of those there and present and voting in order to secure the proposal that was being debated. I was in the conference chamber listening to the debate. The greatest minds in Methodism were on both sides of the argument, arguing passionately their case. And in the end, the vote was taken, and by a significant majority beyond 75%, Methodism voted itself out of existence. Of course, in those days, we didn't have the internet, immediate communication, and in those days, the church didn't yet have its synod, hadn't yet been blessed with its synod. Oh, my gosh. You were still in your convocations, and so we had to wait for the results from the three houses, and they came in, and disappointingly, they got just about 70%. It was just a small vote in one of the houses that actually sank the scheme. And the small vote? The small vote was the cobbling together of a certain kind of Anglo-Catholic and a certain kind of evangelical, people who never do anything together, usually, but just enough to sink the scheme. Not since Essays and Reviews in 1860 had that kind of a conjunction of opposites managed to produce a vote that was as damaging to the church as this one. I won't go on because I'd have to be personal about what I then saw happening to the Church of England. All I know is that Michael Ramsay, man of God, cried his eyes out and, if we're to believe his biographer, wanted to resign from his position as Archbishop of Canterbury. It was a dreadful moment. Those of you who felt how dreadful it was a year or so ago to lose that vote on women bishops must just imagine that those of us who are Methodists felt just as passionately let down by the outcome of that vote in 1969 as ever you lot did a year ago on the other issue. And out of that, the psychology of a body that has voted itself out of existence is a very interesting one to examine. We had laid off developing our liturgical manual for years because we were waiting for the time when Anglicans and Methodists together would develop a common worship book together. And then suddenly we found, blow me, we haven't got a tool for the job, a modern liturgy, and now the Anglicans are not with us. We're all naked in the liturgical chamber, and so we produced very hastily, over hastily, a rather poor little thing that for 25 years we were landed with. We now have the best service book that any denomination, including yours, has. In order to follow your common worship, you have to have 4 thumbs and 10 fingers, because you have to be in the right bit of the book. But with ours, you just turn the page. Much easier. And these marvelous liturgical exercises, these wonderful communion services, seasonal, all the rest of it, they're just beautiful. Anyway, but that was one instance. Another, we left off ordaining women because we wanted to be fair to the Church of England with whom we were going to be making common cause. So it was 1974 before we ordained women, when we should have been ordaining them a generation before. All those things were the attempt to get the dead donkey onto its feet again. We have come with a lot of baggage. Subsequent events have not succeeded, and we're still pretty much in our respective corners. 10 years ago, just yesterday, I was in Ludlow with Neil Richardson, who 10 years ago was the president of our conference. 10 years ago, in Westminster Abbey, Neil signed on behalf of the Methodist Church a covenant, which was countersigned by Rowan Williams, the Archbishop of Canterbury, and in the presence of Her Majesty the Queen in Westminster Abbey. Well, you can't do better than that. 10 years later, if before I just told you that that had happened, I'd ask all of you, were you aware of what happened in Westminster Abbey 10 years ago? I'll bet that 95% of you would not have known. What happened after that in the Anglican Communion was that a prepossession to heal the Anglican Communion took over everything else. And people were running around the world trying to cobble together enough unity around the Windsor Report, this covenant that was going to solve the problems or at least hold you fast together through those terrible times as you debated homosexuality and the rest of it. And it was called a covenant. So the covenant for Anglicans became that effort to rescue the Anglican Communion, and everybody forgot. And when Richard Charters suggested to me that he might bring me into the threefold ministry of the Church of England, it was because he had just come from a conference of bishops where, reporting on the progress of that covenant I've just mentioned, the then leader on that subject in the House of Bishops said, that there was nothing to report. It's time we got this one sorted out. Anglicans and Methodists were made for each other. There was never an intention for there to be a Methodist church freestanding and apart. In Wesley's Chapel, where I worship, the first Methodist church ever built for specifically for the celebration of Holy Communion. Until then, it had been an instruction to all Methodists to go to their parish church for the sacraments. 1778, there were enough Methodists by then who said, we've never been to the parish church. We want communion in our own place. And in 1778, that was granted. But it was 1826, 37 years after the death of John Wesley, that the first person who wasn't in holy orders celebrated the Eucharist in Wesley's Chapel. 1826. We were never intended to be apart. Let me tell you that it was America that caused us to be apart. Why? The Wars of Independence took place. The Bishop of London was the Bishop of America. Well, of course, when the upstarts in America had thrown over the English crown, the Bishop of London wasn't going to do them any favors. John Wesley said to Bishop Louth of London, come on, you got to. There's people out there who are screaming for pastoral care. Send some priests. And Bishop Louth refused again and again. And John Wesley said, I'm afraid that the pastoral needs of the people of America are more important than my obeying you, the Bishop of London, at this moment. And so, invoking an Alexandrian model, which was right or wrong, I don't know, and I don't really care, he did himself ordain people for America, and that was the decisive moment which has been held against us ever since. And it was that Bishop Richard wanted to overturn. Well, all I can say is that if we, Anglicans and Methodists, cannot get our act together, then there's no hope for Christian unity in Britain. This is the touchstone, this is the litmus paper, this is where it all ought to begin. And let me tell you something else. If we can't, we have no right to appeal to the community at large for unity and reconciliation in this area, that area, or any area. Because if we can't do it, what right do we have to ask others to do anything of the sort? I think we shoot ourselves in the foot by behaving as we do. My problem with church unity now is that there is such a residual amount of hostility towards Anglicans in the Methodist Church, because again and again and again we have been rejected at the altar when we went forward to be married, jilted, that the people feel we're never doing that again. And so it requires, my dear friends from the Church of England, it requires an imaginative, generous, full-hearted, welcoming initiative that says, come, we got it all wrong in the past, but this is for real. Come, let's make a common route together. I promise you that unless we find some way of doing it, it'll always be held against us that we're asking others to do what we haven't managed to do ourselves. So, church unity is one of the areas. My worry again is that we'll wait until we are so on the floor that we do it out of desperation instead of as a prophetic act ahead of the game. The church always does that, always waits until everybody else has done it first or until we really are at our wit's end. Why don't we just do it? We'll all forget what the fuss was about in 5 or 10 years' time, and we'll be geared together. I keep on saying to Methodists, I did when I was president of the conference. I did it from conference platforms again and again. I've ceased to believe in the ongoing existence of the Methodist Church. I'll be a Methodist, and I believe in Methodism, but within a larger church. I don't want all the baggage of ecclesiology. I want to be a movement released for mission, part of a movement. If the Catholics can have Jesuits and Franciscans and Dominicans and all the rest of it, why can't the church in England have Methodists as a mission arm? and release all those energies. So ecumenism for me is one big area. Another, where perhaps we might get some steam back again, is in the area of interfaith. Now, we're terrified of interfaith work. Well, many people are, because we don't quite know how to do it. We know that we should, and we try hard, perhaps, and we can all point to neighbours or friends of other faiths and persuade ourselves that perhaps we're doing rather better than we are. But I believe that we've got to develop an apologetics for us as Christians to speak as Christians in an interfaith context that isn't a proselytizing stance, but is a declaration of our identity in those conversations in exactly the same way as a Jew would expect to speak as a Jew and a Muslim as a Muslim. And I think that we need to develop that apologetic. Now, at Wesley's Chapel, if you go into the chapel, we are a very high chapel. We have a little procession going in on a Sunday morning. We ring a bell, and in we go. And you see painted on the back walls two tablets, two wooden panels. And there are the commandments of Jesus. Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul, with all thy mind, with all thy might, on the one. And on the other, matching it, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. Well, now isn't that obvious? The two great commandments of Christ. If anything differentiated Christians from anybody else, that's it. But I'm getting increasingly agitated about those boards. Why? Because they quote almost all the response of Jesus, but not quite. What's missing? What's missing is, the Lord thy God is one, and thou shalt love the Lord thy God, etc., etc., etc. And we have to find a way to talk to Jews and Muslims, fellow monotheists, about our one God, and in some way communicate to them the fact that we are not tritheists or polytheists or whatever. We have to have a theological stance. We have to have an apologetics. We have to have a way of explaining ourselves that makes that mystery clear. Otherwise, we're on the hook with that one all the time. Now, I, at this point, will show you why Anglicans would never take a church that included me in it, because I'm a heretic. Because I just can't stand the Nicene Creed. I know too much about it, the way it came to be. Fabulous minds in Alexandria, Antioch, Jerusalem, Ephesus, Nicaea, all around the Mediterranean world, the finest people, all misunderstanding each other, all having a different understanding of nature and being and all these things. Natura and physis, translate the Latin into Greek or the Greek into Latin. Here it means one thing, it means another thing, another place. Cobbled together, inventing words, homoousios, or was it homoousios? Goodness me, just pluck them out of the air in order to get the equation right, like an algebraic formula. So in the end, it all adds up. And what's it done at the end of the day? Well, it did a marvelous job for its day, although it also had a shadowy side in its day. More people were excluded from the Christian church by the Nicene Creed than included. Right out in the realms beyond the reach of that creed were all kinds of other people who had taken the teaching of Arius rather than Athanasius, for example, very seriously. And goodness me, they had the last laugh because they took over Rome. They came on in and just took over the Roman Empire. But we won't make too much of a case for Arius. I do have a lot of sympathy for him, a lot of sympathy for him. I'd have wanted to talk about one or two of the things that he said, see if we can get it a bit sort of tidied up here and less offensive there and so on. But it was wrong that he should have died in a toilet. I mean, he was worth more than that. And Athanasius gets all the glory. Athanasius was a thug. And the people in Rome just came in. They came in order to settle things in favor of the papacy and the Roman Latin-speaking church. Now, I've probably revealed all my ignorance as well as everything else in saying all these things, but for me, now, it won't do. It's a Greek creed that translates a Semitic experience for an age that is no more. we have to put our best brains now onto the job of getting some way of talking about our God, whom we experience in these various ways, in a way that will allow us with confidence to speak in an interfaith colloquium. So I feel that theologically we're not doing our work. I read A.P.C. Hansen's Search for the Doctrine of God in the Fourth Century. It's a very difficult book and a very long book, a very wonderful book. It unpacks the mystery. But that was the fourth century. So theology's got to be done. Church practice has got to be done. And somehow, can we get off the moralizing? We must be fed up with all of that. What did William Blake say? I can see William Blake's grave from my bedroom window in the winter when the leaves are not on the trees. What did William Blake say? He said, if morality was Christianity, Socrates would be our savior. I mean, Jesus just was on the front foot with everybody he met without ever asking what he needed to ask because he was risk-averse. He didn't want to get too close to people in case they damaged this or threatened that. If it was a leper, if it was a centurion, if it was a woman with a hemorrhage, if it was a... You know, you just all the time into the meeting. Now, how do we get off this hook? Why should we have spent all this time and energy discussing homosexuality? You think what you think, and I think what I think, and if they're different, as John Wesley said, let us differ at the level of our opinions, but let's go forward because there are bigger battles to fight. We've fought all the wrong battles. And in public, so that the whole world can see us tearing each other to pieces, it doesn't make sense. Ludicrous. Now, that's not that I might impose anything I believe on anybody else. I just don't think that's where we need to be most actively engaged. I believe that it's really in terms of saving someone from ruin. It's rescuing someone from their lostness. It's holding the hand out to the lost and the lowest and the least and the last. That's what it's all about. Let me just tell you, in our new hymn book in the Methodist Church, Charles Wesley's wonderful conversion hymn, "Where shall my wandering soul begin? How shall I all to heaven aspire?" Wonderful hymn. It's got a fourth verse that says, "Outcasts of men, to you I call." And because the word men is in it, and we've got a gender working, we've had to change that first line from "Outcasts of men, to you I call," to "Outcasts to you, comma, yes, comma, you, comma, I call, comma." Five commas in eight syllables. And because we've had to do that with the first line, we've lost the second line. "Outcasts of men, to you I call, harlots and publicans and thieves. His open arms embrace you all. Sinners alone his grace receives." Oh, it's wonderful stuff. I am running a campaign in Methodism to reclaim the harlot. I want my harlots back. I just want it said that the whole object of our being converted by the grace of God is that an overflow of grace in us reaches out with the same generosity as we have been reached with. And if it's a harlot, it's a harlot. Come on, love, come with me. In Dylan Thomas's Under Milk Wood. Oh, wonderful Reverend Eli Jenkins. Isn't he marvelous? I mean, Polly Garter, the village prostitute, has been singing about her lovers who are now all dead. I never worked that one out, but too close an association with Polly Garter, and they're all dead. But she's singing about them all, but they're now all buried and dead and gone. She's scrubbing a floor while she sings. And the Reverend Eli Jenkins, before he does his evening prayer for Llareggub, his town, waits for Polly to finish, and then says, "Praise the Lord, for we are a musical nation." He saw the good in her when it would have been so easy to say, "You're a filthy whore." And the church has said, "You're a filthy whore," again and again and again down the ages to sinners of all kinds. and it's time we stopped doing that. Ours is a message of good news. It's a message that warms the heart, brings a smile to the face, puts hope and resolve into a person's deepest being, gives them something to live for, allows them to stand tall, to flourish. Good news. I grew up in that little room in South Wales, just one room. We bathed in it, we did our homework in it, we ate in it, we slept in it, we did everything in it. And I remember sitting with my dear mother, who left school at 13 to go into life of service. And when I knew her in those days, those early days, she was working in a tin plate factory, bestial work, carrying sheets of steel from one part of a process to another. Dear, dear mother, who was soon killed by it all. But I remember her saying to me, "Chapel? I'm not going to chapel. Chapel? Never see me there." Oh, why not? Because she was sending us to Sunday school. Why not? She says, "I smoke fags and I love them. I put sixpence on a horse, each way, mind, but only for the big races. I do the football coupons, Vernon's. I used to post them every week. A little drink now and again. Bingo. Love my bingo." 3 times a week she went. "And I'm divorced. Go to that old chapel. There's 7 sermons for those nasty old preachers to preach about me, telling me what a wicked woman I am." I remember her saying it. I remember believing her that if that chapel could tell me in her presence that she was a wicked woman on any of those grounds, she, the most wonderful person I've ever known, to whom I owe everything that's ever happened to me, if I could hear anybody say she was wicked because she smoked or did the bingo or because she was divorced, whatever, I'd want to kick him in the balls. Because she was the most wonderful woman. And the preaching should have said, "Come on, Alwyn. Come on, Alwyn. Come on. It's for you too." We have spent too much time, wasted too much time, on the wrong things. And it's time we changed. So, at deanery level, don't let the business bit of the agenda get you down too much. Just see where you can share a little bit of energy and find a task, however small, to do together. And if possible, say, "There's those Methodists out there. Should we invite 2 or 3 of them to help us to do this bit of ministry or that bit of ministry or whatever?" Why not? Why not? So there we are, the rantings of an old man. See, I've got to an age now where I just couldn't care tuppence. I've been polite and done it all the proper way for so long that now I'm just going to go out in a blaze of glory. Not that speaking to a meeting of deaneries is glory. But still, it is a privilege to be here, and I thank you for asking me.